show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
This is Steve.
And I'm Pat.
And tonight we're going to talk about preparation, such as doomsday prepping, both short-term and long-term. And I want to get the show underway. I have my lovely granddaughters in town from Ohio, and I want to get home and see my darlings, Michaela and Caitlin.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. And tonight we are going to talk a little bit about being prepared.
How prepared are you? And that question is not as simple as it sounds. And there are different levels of preparation for different levels of situations.
And it's basically pre-planning. And we do this on the basis of a wedding or maybe something on evacuation plan for a fire or flood, that kind of evacuation. Around here, we have a lot of firestorms in the summer, and you may be called to evacuate.
Yeah, if you such things as documents, how do you prepare for your important documents? And preparation is also preparation of skills, not necessarily storing things or having them available, but what are you prepared and capable of doing? What kind of training do you have?
Ben Franklin said, failure to plan is a plan for failure. And a lot of people quote this regarding a diet, but this has to do with everything in your life. Think about how we prepare children just to have a self-sufficient, fulfilling life on their own. That's the whole point of preparing them as children.
Right. I used to scare my poor girls to death preparing them for the white vans without windows.
You're a bad dad. We even teach kids to learn how to swim. In the event that they would ever fall in water, they can survive. And we take that for granted now as adults to teach children how to swim, but it's a form of preparing them.
That's true. There's a lot of things you can prepare them for. You want your children, there are certain situations where they have to act independently, where you have trained them not to do a certain thing, but to how to make decisions.
And that one of those things is, you know, you don't listen to strangers. You don't get in a car with a stranger. You don't fall for that, you know, help me find my puppy or kitty idea. Don't take candy from strangers. All of those things are preparing them to be able to fight for themselves. We should always, when we drop our kids off at school, take 30 seconds to see what they're wearing. In the event that they're kidnapped or they go missing, we can find them.
Also, you know, we part of our baby boomer discussion that we've had on the previous program, we need to teach our kids fundamentally to be self-sufficient anyway. We coddle our children too much. We don't demand that they learn how to do chores anymore, often that they don't have to clean their room, where food comes from. They have no idea how to act in a situation where they're not coddled, and I think we need to change that.
We need to make them prepared. Think about, we're probably, each individually, one of us, will grow to be 80 years old. Are you prepared to live to be 80? Have you taken care of yourself that you will be able to live independently until you're 80? Are you preparing your children to live till they're going to be 80?
Many people my age, I'm in my mid-60s, and there's a lot of people my age who physically have allowed themselves to just be completely unfit. And in the world of today, they manage to get along just fine. But if there's very much adversity at all, those people will not be able to survive or take care of themselves.
And you need to be as mobile as you can. I have a wonderful mother-in-law who's 92 years old, and she is fully mobile. And it's because she's always active. She's always moving. And that's part of the being prepared to live a long time, is you need to be active.
So become independent, become active, keep yourself healthy, and don't be a burden for someone else in the event of a major disaster. Be an asset.
And remember, the Boy Scout motto is always being prepared so you can serve your family in the event of an unexpected event. And we need to take that to heart. And we're not here tonight as with a mindset of doomsdayers or some catastrophic, you know, happening is going to
Although we are going to talk about that.
Yes, we'll be prepared for some catastrophe, but we're not really like militia or conspiracy people or doomsdayers.
And a lot of those people,
I don't think either one of us even has a bunker.
I don't have a bunker.
I don't either.
I do have a hand pump on one of the wells. but a lot of these people have an unrealistic. You know, I have had a relative who has well over 100 guns. And my question is, how many arms do you have? It's great to have all those guns and all that ammo, but how many arms do you have to pull triggers? It's kind of ridiculous.
And we'll get into a little more towards the end of the show about defending yourselves. But and a lot of us are very dependent upon social media, and we'll talk about that. Yes, it can help you locate a missing child. It can help you find a friend or let people know that you're okay in the event of a catastrophe. But if that catastrophe involves electricity, social media might not be able to serve you. So you've got to bear in mind, and can you live without social media for 3 days or 3 weeks?
And how many people have grown up and are adults who've been on some kind of social or governmental assistance for their whole lives who have no concept of how to deal with a major disaster of some kind where they're going to have to go out and fend for themselves, who have always had just never had to make those kind of decisions?
Well, individually, how needy are we? How much do others do for each of us? How much in monetary support or housing or other things that you look to other people on a daily existence? I mean, are you really independent?
And many people think they are. I know I've met a lot of young men, because they ride a motorcycle and they have their own opinions, they believe they're rebels until we find out they're living with their parents. That doesn't make you a rebel.
And, you know, there are reasons why people, young people, live with their parents, and many of them are savings money. But a lot of them don't have the skills to go out in society or have a job. But we're not talking about just this kind of survival. We're talking about being prepared in the event of an unintended catastrophe that may be bigger than your neighborhood.
Well, just to be correct, the statistics I'm hearing about savings in America, they're not living there to save money.
Well, this is
true.
A lot of them
are. Sounds great, but
yes,
they're not.
But chances are that in a catastrophe, this is another body that can help you. These are another set of hands that might be able to help in the situation of a catastrophe. They might be able to help mom and dad.
Right. So don't make them dependent. Make them independent so they can be a help to mom and dad and not a burden. We just need, it's, America used to be that way, where people had to be self-sufficient or they didn't eat. That's not true anymore, and you can have that whole discussion. But in the case of a major emergency, everyone needs to be a producer.
And they need to be mobile. Yeah. If you're not mobile, then you need to have someone around that you can rely on that will help you and not abandon you.
Right. In the healthcare field, I deal with a lot of people who, both respiratory illnesses or motor illnesses where they cannot move. They have to have a power device to get around. And what would they do in an extended emergency with no power?
And we know, we don't have hurricanes or tornadoes or tsunamis here, but we do have firestorms. There's always the danger of a fire that would knock out the power to that property or to a big area for days or weeks. And you have to think, okay, how can I survive 3 days, say, without power?
And we do have dams and we have a flooding possibility.
Yes.
That could be pretty catastrophic, depending
yes.
on what broke and when.
So right now, the local people are talking about having an evacuation list for fire season. And it's interesting. The basics things, we happen to have one posted on our refrigerator, but there you need to have things like alternate ways out of your home. If you have a family and you have a two-story house, children need to know, okay, their bedroom's upstairs. How do they get out of the house in the event of a fire? This is crucial. And where do we all meet on the outside the house? Are we going to go to two doors down? Are we going to go out in the middle of the street? Or do we live on a street with, you know, a big acreage? We need a meeting place so that we can all meet and find out that we're all okay.
Well, if you live in a rural area, some streets have a dead end. Other streets go through. Are you aware on your street what the possibilities are? Or, you know, one of my vehicles can pretty much drive over any fence that I encounter. So can you get away? Because fires have a way of sneaking up and all of a sudden they're there.
And there are roads in this county that go 3 miles before they come to a dead end, but there might be another connecting road just 600 feet past the end of that. You need to know your neighborhood that in the event of a firestorm, how would you get out if you couldn't drive out the road?
Right. And I've been on roads that don't say dead end, but when you get to a certain part of it, unless you're in a pretty robust vehicle, you're not going to get through.
Well, a lot of dirt roads, too. They go back in 2 or 3 miles, and they don't have a dead end signed on them because there's all these little offshoot roads. But unless you've driven on them, you don't know where they go.
Well, and if there's a fire, too, they may not be an egress.
Right. So you need to keep these things in mind. And you should have, with that evacuation list, you should also have a list of not only the people that need to be taken care of, but things that you would want to absolutely take with you. And these are things like hearing aids and eyeglasses and family photos. If you have, a coin collection or stamp collection, something valuable to you that is irreplaceable.
And again, things like family photos and birth certificates and marriage certificates and all of those things, they can be scanned to a CD, which would you can carry with you easily. You can carry hundreds or thousands of documents on CDs. And even in the case of something as radical of an EMP, which we're going to talk about later, a CD would probably survive because of the way it's recorded. So things like that have to be done well in advance, though, and they take a lot of, you know, some work to prepare and to get those done, and you can't do them at the last minute.
And what you want to include with that information is who your home insurance is insured with, what your loan number is, so you can call your lender and say, okay, my house is burned, and I don't have access to my paperwork any longer. I need you to know that I'm not going to be sending you a payment this month because the house is not there. But these kinds of things we don't think of until after the fact. And so put together that list of those important papers. If you have adopted children, you may want adoption papers, copies of those kinds of things available.
And maybe a game plan for how to quickly gather what's most important and take it with you if you need to go. You know, there are many situations. If we had a major epidemic or pandemic, you may actually want to stay home.
Not leave your house.
Right. And are you prepared to do that? And are you prepared to make sure other people who could be infected don't come by? And how would you do that? You know, people have a lot of fantasies about how they would act, but what would you actually do and what are you willing to do?
And that evacuation list, remember your pet. Not only do you want to have a leash for that pet, but you need to have water, food, maybe his bed, but you also want a picture of him. So in the event that you get separated from your pet, someone else may find him. A fireman may save him later, and you need to be able to find him and reunite with that pet. So have a picture of him, even if it's on your cell phone.
And if it's one of those little animals that you carry everywhere, how far are you willing to carry the little animal?
And remember, if you're going to be in a shelter, and oftentimes in an evacuation, people go to a shelter. You may go to a friend's house. But when you're at that shelter, you're going to want your cell phone. You're going to want a charger for your cell phone so you don't have to share someone else's. You're going to want coats, shoes, toothpaste, toothbrush, flashlight, maybe an extra set of car keys. If you have more than one car, you're going to need both of you to drive out. Where are you going to meet? Those kinds of things you need to plan ahead so that you know where we're going to meet, so that we know if someone's missing, so that if someone's en route to home, they know, okay, that's an evacuation center, but our family's going to meet down at Aunt Donna's house, and so I'll go there to see if they've already gotten there.
And social media may or may not be available. So also, when it comes to electronics, be aware. How many people out there have an old-fashioned landline that doesn't require power? You know, I have two of those, and if you lose power but the physical landline is still there, your telephone will work. It'll actually ring, and you can talk on it.
And the rotary phones will work. They don't need the digital analog.
Right, that's what I mean. It's I actually have a rotary. I think it's two of the rotary phones now. The original digital phones will work because they did the same thing the dial-up phone did.
Yeah.
The new push buttons won't work. They're all electric. But the old ones, the ones from the 60s and maybe the 70s, they will still work. And it'd be a good idea to have some of those. They're still not that expensive to get. And you put them in a closet. And when you need them, if you don't have power, you do have telephone unless the exchange is down.
And your cell phone, like I say, you want to have your charger, but oftentimes communications get clogged up and you can't call out because there's just too many calls going. So, but texting will get through when phone calls won't. So you can text that family member to find out where they are or to let someone else in the family know that you're safe. So texting will be far more efficient than actual telephone use in the event of a catastrophe.
If you have cellular service, and so many people rely on social media so much, I get a little concerned about if there's any kind of a major electrical disaster or something. If they have no alternate plan other than social media for communication, it could be pretty disastrous.
And social media is invaluable if you do have power, because not only can you talk to other family members, but you can also call out for help or trying to find an animal or something else that would work in the event of catastrophe, as long as you do have that power.
And if it's just a power outage, but you still have some kind of internet access, if you only had power, keep in mind that you don't have to have a big generator. If you have a marine battery and a small inverter, you can power a modem and a router and even a laptop and a computer.
That boat sitting in the backyard might not be useless than money you just throw in a hole.
Right. There's ways to have power for those kind of devices that you wouldn't need the kind of power you need for running a refrigerator or something like that.
I want to give you a couple of websites that you might want to visit. One's www.ready.gov. It'll give you lists of evacuation lists and first aid things that you might want to have on hand. Or http://emergency-cdc.gov also has a separate different scenarios that in a case of an emergency of different kinds, especially if you're going to travel this summer and you're not used to being in hurricane territory or something like that, these websites might help you. Remember, you can only live, 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food? Each person needs a half a gallon of water per day to drink to keep you hydrated and keep you fit and movable.
Yeah, I hope so. I drink about half of that.
Well, but you probably drink coffee or sodas or juice, but you need a minimum of a half a gallon of water per day. And that's, you know, like I say, most people don't drink that in water because they consume all these other liquids.
including the diuretics like coffee.
Yes, but remember that when you're planning, okay, that 3 minutes without air, if you're in a home that's fire and smoke, get down on the ground to get out because that air will be saturated with smoke in just a matter of seconds. 3 minutes isn't very long for a house to be consumed by smoke.
And you may be able to last 3 weeks without food if you've been eating well up to that point. But are you willing to go 3 weeks without food?
Most likely not. I don't think I could go 3 weeks without food. I doubt if I could go 3 days without food. I'd be eating something. I'm not sure what. But think about this when you, not in necessary an evacuation plan, but if you were to be stuck at home, like Steve had suggested, maybe a pandemic that the CDC comes out and say, everybody stay at home. We have some sort of major contagion. Or in the event of a major power outage that's the whole state, people may want you to stay home. And you may not even know to have to stay home because you're out of power. You don't know what's going on. But plan ahead. If things after 12 hours, if things don't come back to normal, you might just want to do a tentative plan.
Right. And how are you prepared for things like first aid and food and water? How much food and water do you have? Because you have to think, you know, well, I have enough to last me a week. Okay, well, then you're prepared to eat. But if the situation lasts longer than a week, then what? And what kind of food do you save? A lot of people get these prepackaged dried meals, and I don't know how many of them they store up, but usually they're an amount of food to last you for a day. I mean, how many of those can you save? Where if you have access to water, say you have a well or something like that, you know, you can buy beans by the 50-pound bag, and those can last you for months and months, dried beans, and they'll keep forever. So what kind of food are you storing, and what's your realistic situation? Do you want to be prepared for a day, a week, a month? Think about what you want to be prepared for and prepare for that, but do it in a realistic fashion. Think it through.
With our markets, supermarkets have what they call just-in-time inventory, where product is delivered every day and put out on the shelves. Strategically, they say there should not be more than 3 days' worth of food on the shelves in a grocery store so that they don't pay for inventory that's not being sold. So there is only 3 days in the grocery store. So are you going to have time to go to the grocery store? You might want to have a few. Winco, Costco, they all have prepackaged food for 87 servings or something like that. They also have these big number 10 cans that come in fruits, vegetables, rice, whatever. You may just want to have a dozen of those on hand that mix with water. It might not be the meal of your desire that day, but it's better than going without anything. And when you're desperate for food, you will eat those things that you don't like.
Right. And, you know, the prepackaged meals, that's all well and good, but I, for one, don't want to spend that kind of money on my preparations. That's why I mentioned the things like dried foods, like Pat mentioned rice, dried milk. So water is one of the least expensive things you can keep on hand, and it is bulky and takes a lot of storage. It'd be nice if you have a well or something like that. If you don't, you know, you can get those 5 gallon jugs of water. You can get 1 gallon jugs of water, but have plenty of water. And if you do, then dried food, you know, a lot of it will go a long ways and be a lot less expensive than storing prepackaged dried food.
They even have these water bottles. They're actually have a filter built into them, and they're not that expensive. You're talking about $20, and a lot of these fancy water bottles that don't do anything or insulate your water is $20. But these are actually have a filter that you can take pond water and run it through and drink it through the straw, and it will clean that water so that you're safe to drink it. Otherwise, you're going to have to boil water, and you need to boil if I'm not mistaken, it's 30 minutes when you boil water. Let me look that up.
Boiling water is actually disinfects it, but doesn't really.
Right.
30 minutes might do a pretty good job, but things like pressure cookers actually put water at a higher temperature than boiling, and that's why they can sterilize and can.
One of the things to remember is the 21 method to purify water, and that's 2 drops of bleach for 1 quart of water, and you let that stand for 30 minutes. That's 21. That's 2 drops per 1 quart of water, and 21 is our legal age for drinking, so it might be an easy way to remember that. You can convert that to, say, a gallon jug of milk. That jug is empty. It holds a gallon. You put 8 drops of bleach in it, in that gallon, and let it stir it and let it sit for 30 minutes and you can drink it.
And keep in mind that if, as part of your preparation, if you keep a supply of bleach on hand, bleach has a shelf life, so it doesn't keep forever. So you want to keep that replenished.
Yeah. And boiling water takes 3 minutes to kill the organisms in it, but that's once it comes to a boil. So if you have water, say, rain water out of your rain gutters, but obviously you're going to pick out the debris, but you're not going to want to drink it. So you'd want to boil it at least 3 minutes before you strain it and drink it.
Yeah, and you probably do want to strain it considering the roofing material that it just came off of.
Right, right. But let's talk a little bit about in the event that you're stuck in your car somewhere. Because this is another way that we need to be prepared, especially when people go out camping. Most people have a camp bag, say a go bag, set up to where you have everything you need in a backpack or a piece of luggage or something like that. And you design that like you were going camping with the idea of rules in camping, be aware of your surroundings. But you also have to plan for snake bite because you're going out camping. So, and they're active between 60 and 90 degrees, and usually you don't see them until they rattle, and then you got to get out of the way. But those kinds of things you plan for. But you may need a different kind of, say, bug-out bag that you would take in the event of having to leave your home.
Or what do you keep in your car every day? Because you're not necessarily going to be home in the case of a major disaster. You might be 5 miles away, 10 miles away in your car. you run out of fuel, or there's an EMP and your car doesn't work, or for whatever reason you're on foot now, how do you get home? Do you have a plan for that? Do you have a map? Will your GPS be working or not? And if not, what's the plan for how to get home? What kind of things do you keep in your car all the time?
You should have always a pair of walking shoes. You should have a rain poncho, which is used for many things, not just rain. It can collect water for you if you're going to be out overnight and you need water. It can do a lot of things, but it's also a source of protection. It can keep in body heat. It can keep out water. And they're like $2.
Well, one thing that I also learned about was if you're in your car and there is no major disaster, but all of a sudden you're stuck on the freeway for 8 hours because of a major traffic jam, and you have to go to the bathroom, and it's not number one. And what do you do? Do you have a can or something in your car? Are you willing to go out there outside in a treeless environment with all these people? A poncho might be handy for that, too.
Anything's possible. But you would want to have a flashlight, a map, even though we have navigation on our phones. If your phone runs out of battery and your car's not running, you're at the mercy of a map. So you might still carry one in your map, in your car.
Yeah, you can get pretty compact map books that cover the area that you generally are in. Things like matches you may not need, but do you have a lighter or matches if you do need them? Do you have a flashlight? Headlamps are handy because you have both hands free. Do you have a way to protect yourself? What kind of things do you have in the event? Do you keep a first aid kit in your car? And what should you have in a first aid kit?
Even a utility knife might be useful in your car. Let's do talk about a first aid kit. A lot of people have that first aid kit in their car that they bought. You know, when they bought their car, it comes with a little first aid kit. But that's usually designed for a one-day event.
Actually, not even that. Just a very small, manageable thing to get you to the doctor or the hospital.
Right. But if you're stuck at home or their roads are not passable, say in the event of an earthquake, we're in a major earthquake fault area, even though they used to say we weren't, we are. We also live in the shadow of two volcanoes, Lassen and Mount Shasta. So in the event of, say, something unpredictable, what do you have in that first aid kit? How can you help someone else that's in your household that might be injured?
Right. What if there's a major injury that you can do something, but you don't have the materials? You know, first of all, everyone can get a first aid certification that does more than put Band-Aids on people. Have you been trained? Have you taken the time to be trained for that? What do you do if you have a wound that won't stop bleeding? You know, crazy glue is a great wound binder. And so your first aid kit, as intuitive as it sounds, should probably have something like crazy glue in it.
And a bar of soap that you can actually clean a wound with, or Neosporin ointment to put on it after you've cleaned it. Those bandages that are bigger than, you know, a regular Band-Aid. The 4x4 Telfa pads or disinfectant type of spray, any of those things that in the event of a wound, you're able to take care of it, and you may even have to stitch something.
And how much of that do you have? Because, if you're stuck in place for several days or a week and somebody has just gotten kind of a big injury, you're going to need to redress that wound. You may need to do other things to it. So you need, for Band-Aids, for instance, you need boxes of Band-Aids and ones of different sizes. And those dressings, you need a box of those, not just one or two. The Neosporin, the soap, you need enough to last you. One thing you can do for soap is most people, use a bar of soap until it's pretty small and then they throw it away. Keep all those little pieces of soap and put them in a box, and it's amazing how much soap you can build up over time unless you don't shower much, and that's a different show.
And rubbing alcohol. Get the 90% rubbing alcohol that you keep on hand just for all kinds of other things, cleaning acne or whatever, even taking a shower. Some people use a little bit of alcohol to help dry out the zits and stuff as teenagers. But get the 91%. That way you can at least clean a wound with it.
Right. Be prepared. Have enough first aid to last you for more than prepping for a quick trip to the hospital or the doctor.
We'll be right back with some more ideas.
I'm Steve.
I'm Pat.
This is Examine Life on KKRN 88.5 FM. And this is community supported TV, so be the community and support your station.
It's actually radio, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I can see me and I can see you.
One thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
Welcome to Examine Life. Tonight we're talking about being prepared just for the unexpected events in life.
From everything from a small, quick disaster to a major, long-term, how well are you prepared to survive and thrive?
This week, up in the Northwest, Washington, Oregon area, for the whole week, there are 20,000 first responders that are doing drills for the possibility of an earthquake on the Cascadia Fault. And that fault line runs 600 miles out in the ocean from San Francisco all the way to British Columbia.
So it could just basically split our state right in half, right?
Well, it probably would do more damage in Washington and Oregon because California has the mountain range on the northern portion of the state. But it will cause, they believe, it'll cause a major tsunami. This fault was just discovered over the last 20 years. Actually, the last 10 years, they've discussed it extensively. And now they're starting to believe that it could happen, and they're taking preparatory action.
Well, the notes here say a fracture in Shasta Dam. I would say that directly affects us.
Well, that would. It could cause a tsunami. It could cause a fracture in the Shasta Dam. Bridges could go out. It could even cause a volcanic eruption of Shasta or Lassen because they believe that it could be the size of 9 point something.
And I also heard, but I don't remember the specifics, that fault, if it had a major event, could trigger some other faults.
Yes.
And cause quakes further down in California and other states.
Scientists at the University of Japan, they say that they expect at least 4 earthquakes of a magnitude of 8 or higher along the Pacific Rim within the next 5 years. That, something that's an 8.0 is major.
Right. Those things go, every movement of 0.1, I think, is 10 times the previous one. But
I think it's much higher than that.
No, just of 0.1.
Oh, each point.
Like,
okay.
Not 8.1 to 8.2 is, I think, 10 times the strength. Might be bigger.
But they, you know, in the last 60 days, they've had major events on that rim of fire. Off Australia, Ecuador, and Japan. And Japan is really taking this stuff seriously now. They believe that the upcoming ones will be 8 or greater magnitude. And that's the Cascadia Fault. Even an 8 on that would possibly impact us dramatically here.
And you can't blame that on people. It's just the fact that those earthquakes have not been occurring is what makes them more likely.
Right. And I think they're taking this so seriously is because the Cascadia Fault is supposed to, historically, they finally realized that it's about every 340 years, more or less. And it's been like 360 years since the last time it moved. And now they're beginning to get a little anxious. But who knows when the next one will be. But at least those drills will be going on this whole week up there.
And the important thing to think about when it comes to survival and being prepared and so on is realize how much, just in the last 50 years, how dependent we have become on the infrastructure that if it collapses, it's not there. So how well are you prepared to deal without having an infrastructure?
And again, this is where planning. Your family is the most important thing to you in the major catastrophe. So talk to them. Okay, if there's a warning that the dam has, say, structural weakness, it may not have burst, but have a plan immediately to move. Because when the dam, if it should burst, would be major in this city.
Right, and there are things called inundation tables that you can get access to, probably on the web. I didn't have time to research that. But you can discover where you are in terms of risk when it comes to things like a dam rupture. You know, how will you flood or will you not, or what's the likelihood of that? And if you do, if you are going to, what are your routes of egress? And that can come from those same tables.
So you always want to stay calm and think logically. And I've always told my kids and grandkids, what you don't know that you don't know is the biggest danger in life. Those unknown facts and conditions can cause unexpected catastrophe. So pay attention when there is a major earthquake. Even if it didn't affect you that day, oftentimes the aftershocks can cause as much damage as the initial quake.
And how prepared are you to help your neighbors? You know, to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem. How dependent on you, we talked about earlier. How prepared are you to be part of the solution to help other people and not just take care of yourself? I had heard about a situation once where a fellow went and got some high school lockers that had keys that were, you know, surplus. And his plan, in the event of a major disaster, he had a farm and was able to get food, or grow food and so on. And his plan was to have keys for those lockers and actually hand them out to people that were hungry and say, whatever's in the locker today will be yours. And if you bring the key back, you'll have another shot at having access to a locker.
On another day.
Yeah.
Being prepared gives you and your kids confidence, and it causes less anxiety in the event of a major catastrophe. Having that bag or a plan and any kind of plans. And a way to get away from that or get information empowers you. So you do have more confidence. That short band weather radio might be something you want to have handy at home.
And something that has a hand crank and rechargeable batteries that you can constantly keep charged. I found a really nice citizen band kind of, not a CB, but a citizen band FM radio that is two-way. That has a hand crank and a flashlight and a way to charge your cell phone and everything all in one unit. And they're not that expensive, and you have guaranteed power.
And Father's Day is coming up.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Canada most recently published an article in their newspaper that they should be prepared for an EMP, and they felt vulnerable enough to publish this in the paper. And the extreme prepper movie, there's a couple of them that are out. One of them is 10 Cloverfield Lane. This is about a family that goes in a bunker because of some major catastrophe. I haven't seen it, but I hear it's a little scary. And, you know, we've seen San Andreas, the movie, the outbreak, the pandemic movies. There's also one coming out called Amerageddon, which is about the end of times for the United States. So all of these things are your extreme preppers type of scary things, but you don't have to be an extreme prepper just to be prepared for a catastrophe.
Yeah, you don't, you know, you attach some logic to it and decide, do I want to be prepared for all kinds of major disasters? And you can do that. You can be prepared to last for years on your own. You know, you can have property where you can grow your own food and you have access to the water without having power and all of those things. Or you can choose not to do that, but understand what you're prepared for and what you're not prepared for. And an electromagnetic pulse is a little bit far-fetched in most of our minds, but it's actually a lot of countries are acquiring nuclear weapons, and all it takes is a nuclear weapon. We're not talking about nuclear war. We're talking about a device that destroys all electronic and electrical activity within a certain radius, and that's everything. And you wouldn't get an announcement that that had happened because announcements come electronically. So one day you wouldn't have power, and you'd think the power was out, but maybe not.
And you're not going to see it necessarily because this could happen 300 miles up in the atmosphere.
Right.
So it would be suddenly there would just be no power.
It doesn't have to have visible light.
Right. And if
and even if it does, we see things like that and many times think it's lightning or something.
Discount it. So there again, that emergency band radio might be able to help you figure out what has happened. If your power is out for more than 12 hours and you start, you know, talking to the neighbors and theirs is out and, you know, nightfall comes and you don't see any lights anywhere, then you might begin to get a little suspicious.
If the hand crank radio will work if you've protected it from that electromagnetic pulse.
We'll get into that in a minute. Ted Koppel wrote a book called Lights Out, and it's about a cyber attack on the grid. It's not an EMP, a pulse. It's about literally a foreign government that comes in and compromises our power grid. That book was endorsed by an FBI director, a former FBI director. The prior Homeland Security chief has talked about that as a likely possibility. And the head of the CIA says that's one thing keeps him up at night is a cyber attack on one of our critical infrastructures, trains, our financial districts, even major cities that would be attacked simultaneously without power.
And if there's one thing we know, it's that both government and government-affiliated power companies have about as much security as a screen door on a submarine.
Yeah, so. And anything can be hacked. And they already discovered in California, Northern California at the university, they had found that in routine maintenance in the power grids at PG&E, they had found that there was a worm just sitting there waiting for something to happen. They identified it as a foreign government had planted it. And they now suspect that they're everywhere. They just stumbled across one by sheer chance.
Not to mention some guys, sometime within the last couple of years, I think, who had physically with guns had planned to shoot up a major transformer that would have affected a very large number of people. And I'm not sure exactly why it didn't happen, but the security wasn't there to prevent it until after the fact, but it never occurred.
It was in 2013 in San Jose at the PG&E plant or power station there, and it said only for the fact that the guy was a lousy shot that damage wasn't done.
Right. So there are many, you know, people could blow up, say, 10 overpasses in strategic locations, and your grocery store would be out of food in about a day or two.
Yeah. Even a solar flare. The last one was in 1859. And of course, we weren't dependent upon electricity then. The only thing it really blew out was the telegraph. And that was basically the military and the railroads were dependent upon the telegraph. So it didn't impact the average person. But this day and age, we are totally dependent upon electricity. So it would have a major impact on us.
And solar flares, we don't see coming.
No, and they don't know when that would occur.
Right.
And it's a possibility, remote as it might sound. It could also take out a big portion of electronics and power.
And depending on the type of solar flare, if there is any warning, it's about an 8-minute warning.
Let's talk a little bit about the Faraday bag or protection. You can talk about Michael Faraday, I'm sure.
Well, I don't need to talk about him in depth. Michael Faraday is just the guy who came up with the equations. He's most famous for the equations having to do with magnetism. But people talk about a Faraday cage, which is basically a metal lattice structure like a screen or something like that that interferes with the type of electromagnetic pulse, spreads it out so that it won't damage things within the Faraday cage.
Similar to a lightning rod with lightning.
Now, there's a lot of contested thought about that. People say, well, you know, you have to be underground and lead-lined, and other people say, well, a trash can works. But what the actual truth is the strength of the electromagnetic pulse determines the answer to that question. If it's close enough and strong enough, a trash can will not work.
Michael Faraday was a British physicist and chemist, and he was an engineer pioneering magnetism. In 1821 is when he actually published that theory on the principle behind transformers and generators. And interestingly, that cage is it will block a cell phone use if you're inside the area. And like they do in elevators or medical facilities, sometimes even theaters will block cell phone use, but it won't stop a compass from working. So it's a very fine kind of line that it works on.
Right. It kind of, again, depends on the strength of the pulse or whatever it is you're dealing with, because it can be overwhelming in strength.
And it works similar to that shield wallet that you see advertised where it protects your credit cards from being scammed while you're walking around. And that's usually made of aluminum foil and duct tape. But, I mean, it's still the same theory, is that they can't get around that aluminum foil and duct tape to grab the information off your coated credit
card. But I could just use that hat that I wear to protect me from the aliens, and exactly. I could just reform that and protect my wallet. So.
And I believe you would. But they do say that a metal trash can would work, that even four layers of heavy-duty aluminum foil would work in most cases. But who knows what it is you're trying to protect, and you can't have any slits even if you build a Faraday cage. You know, it's got to have duct tape on those slits and all that kind of stuff. So making your own is probably not the easiest thing.
And keep in mind that, you know, things like CDs are kind of impervious to an electromagnetic pulse, because those are that's a physical burning of something into the medium. So saving those documents and so on a CD, they should be protected from that.
They say you could even store your cell phone in the microwave oven overnight. That has the same Faraday cage idea, to work on the inside the oven and not let those rays out.
Right. And keep in mind that if you, you know, we talk about data backups. You need to back up your computer data if you plan to use it in the future. How often do you back up? If you do a lot of work in one day, but you back up once a week, you're going to lose that information. And how do you back up? If you back up to the cloud and you have a local power outage, you'll be fine. The cloud will be there. But if you back up to the cloud and there's an EMP, that data's gone, just so that you know that.
Well, you probably won't ever need it again anyway.
Well, maybe, maybe not. An EMP does damage, but it's not permanent. It's, you know, things have to be repaired. But just depends on what your data is used for.
Right.
Like all those pictures we talked about. If you store those, they're lost forever. If you put them on a CD, they're not.
Right. And most people should have their personal information on a CD. Again, back to that Faraday idea. They sell, Father's Day's coming, there is those Faraday bags you can buy online. They did say that you should get the 3M-tested anti-static bags, because the other ones may or may not work for what, you know, the normal Faraday effect that you want. But it's an interesting concept if you're want to be prepared for that kind of thing. Who knows if it'll ever happen? Like I say, the movies right now that are coming out and the warnings on the politics, and so it's in the news.
Yeah, and it's interesting. These movies come out every decade. I remember when I was a kid, you know, the idea of a thermonuclear bomb, and all you had to do was put your head between your knees and hide under your desk, and you'd be safe. So,
well, earthquakes, you know, we're taught as kids that in the event of an earthquake, you get under your desk, you find a closet that won't, you know, shake until it falls down.
Stand in the door frame.
Stand something that protects you. But in soon as the earthquake is done, then go outside and make sure you're clear of any buildings that are going to fall down, because the aftershocks are going to cause more shaking. So you want to be protected while it's happening inside and then run outside after the fact.
Yeah, again, how prepared are you to act? You know, do you keep yourself in shape? Can you run when you need to run? Can you climb when you need to climb? That's important. A lot of people, again, my age, don't need to be in the shape that they're in, and they could not survive. They could not run anywhere. They couldn't walk for any distance. And that, when it's a lifestyle thing, that's your own fault. You can prevent that.
And you might even have in your garage some supplies like a, you know, duct tape, plastic sheeting, a clear tarp, scissors, knives, shovels, in the event that you had to make a temporary shelter for your pet or yourself for a couple of days, in the event that an earthquake happens and your home is destroyed.
Right. I realized when we had the fires a couple of years ago, the Cloverdale fires that came really close to my place, that I had an evacuation plan for the sheep, I had an evacuation plan for the family, but I didn't have one for the chickens. And that was an issue for me.
Well, you'd be surprised. We had a fire when our kids were very young, and I just turned all the animals loose and just left with the children. But interestingly, the firemen collected the animals for you.
Well, I had a place to send my sheep, and so a friend helped me with that. But, you know, my chickens, we don't want to lose them. We don't want them to burn to death. And so even though they're chickens and they're birds, you should have a way to get them. I would enjoy seeing the firemen gather up my chickens. That might be fun.
I don't know that they'd gather chickens, but right. They'd probably come home at night to eat anyway. So it's probably a safe bet your chickens will be taken care of.
Yeah, coming home and eat to burning, no. Anyway.
One of the other things that you should maybe want to have on hand is that how-to book. You know, basic survival, you can get them, the Boy Scouts have them. Every bookstore has all kinds of them. You know, how to make a fire if you don't have a cigarette lighter or something else. All of these kinds of things are just nice to have available if you ever do need that how-to and there is no power that you can look it up on the Internet. The Internet's fabulous for information, but you might just want to have one or two of those books. I have one that's called A Cow in the Cupboard, and it talks about how if you have just dry powdered milk, how you can make all these different things in the dairy fields, from yogurt to milk to sour cream, out of that powdered milk. So it's just knowledge that I don't bank that kind of stuff. I've never had to do it. But I have this little book that tells me in the event of a catastrophe.
And, of course, the Internet is a great source of information. But keep in mind the type of disasters we're talking about. So if you do get something from the Internet, make a physical printout.
Yeah.
don't save it on your computer.
And if you're going to store some food, the cans of tuna, the cans of chicken, protein. You're going to want to have some protein. Rice and beans are nice and, the canned fruit and those kinds of things, the pastas. But you're going to want some meat. And not everyone's going to be able to go out and kill something. So you want that canned chicken.
You do want meat, but keep in mind some things like peas and beans do have protein.
Yes.
Having a half dozen chickens, you can have eggs, but not everybody lives where they can have chickens and eggs.
They even have dehydrated eggs now. You can get them
they've had them a long time ago. They had them back when I was a kid. There were government surplus stations that gave you powdered eggs.
And the powdered cheese, you can go online and find any of this stuff. But even Winco has all kinds of dehydrated vegetables, dehydrated fruit. I think they even had something like apple crisp or some sort of like quasi-dessert type thing. And they're number 10 cans, so there's considerable number of servings in there. And, you only need 10 or 12 of those to get by for a week or two.
Right.
So, and you would want to, plan on rationing your food. But all of the dehydrated stuff has same nutrients in it as if you ate it fresh. And you just mix it with water.
And what kind of things do you keep around your house? Pat mentioned duct tape earlier. Tools, duct tape, pocket knife, things for your car, rope, and waterproof matches and blankets and jackets. And what do you have around the house to get you through a time you may have to do repairs? You may have to break yourself out of a broken structure. Who knows? What kind of tools do you have at your house and in your go bag?
And one thing about water, in the event of a catastrophe, fill up your bathtub immediately before other people start flushing their toilets and waste all that good water.
Yeah.
Eventually, if the power's out, they're not going to be able to pump water into that line. And if you fill up your bathtub, you'll be amazed at how many days' worth of water that bathtub holds. and you're not going to flush it down the toilet because it's too valuable.
Right. There are a lot of little things you can do. You know, you can make lists. I'm terrible at making lists, but it's a good idea, you know, of how you would do based on what kind of a situation you're in. You know, there's immediate disasters, there's short-term disasters, there's fires, there's floods. What would you do in each case? Because each one's going to have a different set of necessary responses.
And there, you should have a way to defend yourself. In the event of a major, you see this on the news oftentimes in areas where there's flooding or there's something else, and you have, or even rioting where there's looting going on and all the stores get emptied out. You want to be able to defend yourselves if you're in the city or you're in a rural area. So you plan on having something.
And because what I talked about earlier, you know, how many people out there are dependent on a government program or a family to take care of them. And generally speaking, people in those situations feel entitled to having their things given to them. And if they're not being given to them, they're going to come and look for it from you.
Well, though, if there is a major catastrophe and there's no the law is preoccupied with getting order restored on a health level, there's going to be some lawlessness. And that's what you have to protect yourself against. And you, like I say, it may be everybody in the condo project pulls together to make sure that, you know, you pull your resources and you have defensible perimeter. Something like that. You'd be surprised at in the times of crisis. Desperate people do desperate things, and smart people do good planning or pull together.
And beyond the people who are just looking for food or shelter, there are those who want chaos but are restrained somewhat by the law. And if they feel like the law is not existent at the moment, they're going to go out and look for chaos.
Interesting show that comes on the Weather Channel. It's called So You Think You Could Survive. And one of the statistics that I found was very interesting is one of the major killers of weather-related incidents are flash floods. They kill more people than hurricanes or anything else. So if you go camping and you're in a low-lying area, be sure and pay attention to the weather.
Right, or just driving through an area on a rainy night when you can't really see the terrain around you.
And the extreme preppers, I'm not one to have a bunker. My theory is, why do I want to be the last one alive? For what? You know, I don't understand that concept of being the last one on Earth. But if you are one of those, then you got nothing out of this program. The rest of you, I'd like to have it as a seed for thought.
And as I said earlier, how can you be part of the solution? Because, you know, to me, that makes life a little better. Just surviving, I mean, you're going to die someday anyway. So how can you be part of the solution? How can you help provide food for others when there's an emergency? Think about that instead of just thinking about yourself and you know, what you would do for yourself or even your family. Your family's going to come first, but then what do?
And you're a role model for those children that you're raising. Let them know you can be strong, you can be a leader. Having a plan gives you confidence.
Right. This has been Examine Life on KKRN 88.5 FM, community-supported radio.
And I'm Pat.
And another shout out to my nieces, Michaela and Caitlin.
And if you'd like to contact us, it is examinelife@kkrn.org.
And please do. We enjoy opinions for and against, and we would like to hear from you about the program. examinelife@kkrn.org. Have a wonderful night and be prepared.
Good night.
Good night.